I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Why does one city succeed while another much like it is left behind? Today on Smart City, we take a look at the history of two industrial towns and the uncertain future of Cleveland. Sean Safford is the author of the book, Why the Garden Club Couldn't Save Youngstown, The Transformation of a Rust Belt City. He'll tell us about the history of two former steel towns and why one succeeded while the other languished. We'll also speak with Terry Schwartz of the Cleveland Urban Design Collaborative. She'll tell us about the unique challenges of redeveloping the communities in the city of Cleveland and how she is using design to reimagine the shrinking city. All that, plus the news from Planet Edison's Nate Berg and our City Views commentator Walker Smith, coming up on today's Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Can a city have too much social capital? Can the social networks be so tight as to create strangulation? Sean Safford has explored those questions by studying the histories of Allentown, Pennsylvania, and Youngstown, Ohio, two steel towns that enjoyed very different fates, in part because of the different ways their citizens were connected to one another. His research is documented in his new book, Why the Garden Club Couldn't Save Youngstown. I began by asking Sean about the value of social capital as described in an earlier book by Robert Putnam, Bowling Alone. Sean, you've been a guest on Smart City before, but your new book is out, and we're excited, and we wanted to have an opportunity to talk with you again. Explain the fundamentals of why the Garden Club couldn't save Youngstown, Ohio.
The idea that Robert Putnam puts out there is that dense social ties are like the oil in an engine that lubricate economic activity. But the question that I had going into this research wasn't so much about how economic activity gets facilitated, but when the way that an economy works starts to break down, how do you change? How do you adapt? Often what we find with dense social connections is that they hold back change. People tend to cling to the way things were, and it makes it more difficult actually to adapt to a quickly changing economically difficult environment. And so what I found in this research, you know, comparing Allentown and Youngstown, was that in Youngstown, those dense connections, on the one hand, people clung to old ways of thinking, but at the same time, because they were so closely connected to the way that the economy was structured around the steel industry, when the steel industry collapsed, the tight core of leadership in Youngstown collapsed with it. And what that meant was that different parts of Allentown that were needed to figure out how to adapt went off and spun off in different directions. So the unions went off and did their own thing. The African-American community downtown did a different thing. The suburbs went off in one direction. The business leaders that were left went and did their own thing. And so nobody was cooperating. And that was the real difference between Youngstown and Allentown. In Allentown, those connections weren't as dense, but there were places where union leaders and the Hispanic community and the business community and the educational folks, people from the suburbs and people from the city could come together and at least talk about what needed to happen as the steel industry was collapsing. And out of that came a set of really robust measures and reactions to the economic crisis of the early 80s. And so Allentown has adapted a lot better.
And Sean, were they robust because there were lots of experiments or lots of different kinds of thinking coming from different places going on? I mean, is that the essence of why Allentown had a more robust response to the collapse of their economy?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And the answer is no. There are always really good ideas out there. There are ideas right now floating around and they're everywhere about how cities should adapt to what's going on with the economy. The question isn't so much where do the ideas come from. They come from everywhere. The question is really what do you do with them? So both places, in Allentown and in Youngstown, they had access to the same ideas. Both of them knew that they needed to diversify their economy. They needed to improve their infrastructure. Later on, as innovation technology really started to take off, there were a set of things that were clear that both places could have done. or they had the option to do. The difference between Allentown and Youngstown was that in Allentown they were actually able to do them. They were able to get people together, forge a political coalition, and effectively take action to follow through on some of these good ideas.
All right, but you say, let me make sure I understand what you're saying, Sean, because you said actually that Youngstown, which couldn't save itself and experienced it then a long, slow decline, had very dense connections. And so you would think that, in fact, if both cities had the same access to good ideas, you would think that those dense connections, those close connections, would have facilitated Youngstown's ability to take those ideas and run with them. Explain the difference.
There were two kind of key moments. The first was in the 1950s when it became clear that these inland steel centers like Allentown and Youngstown were no longer going to be viable. One reaction at that point was to either diversify or to figure out a way to remain viable. The dense connections in Youngstown led them down the path of trying to remain viable. The interests of that tight group were very tightly bound to keeping the steel industry strong. And so rather than figure out an infrastructure that would help them to diversify, what they tried to do at that point was to maintain their center as a railroad junction, and at the same time try to actually, you know, it sounds really antiquated at this point, but what they wanted to do was to build a canal to bring shipping from Lake Erie down to Youngstown. So that dense connection in the 50s, it was a force for inertia, keeping them on the path that would ultimately end up failing them. Whereas in Allentown, you didn't have that tight connection. And so the idea to come in and to diversify had more receptive ears. There were more people, more interests being represented, in a sense, in those conversations than just folks interested in the steel industry. Then by the 1970s, when it became clear that this was really collapsing, what you had in that with that tight core of people in Youngstown was the descendants, really, of the people who had founded all these steel mills. They were both in charge economically. They were the people sitting on the bank boards, on the boards of directors of different companies, and the civic institutions. And so the social and the economic networks were tightly intertwined. So when the steel industry started to collapse, those people who had been associated with the steel industry and the leadership that they provided for Youngstown, that sort of tight core that was a force for inertia, really just evaporated. Rather than being a force for inertia, you got inertia out of the inability to take any action at all.
So how would you take those lessons and apply them to today's situation where, again, there are other cities just like those two that are experiencing tremendous upheaval in their industry? I mean, forgetting the immediate economic situation, but just looking longer term, clearly there are some big changes underway. And cities are going to need to adapt. What should they learn from the experience of Youngstown and Allentown to apply to their own communities today?
It used to be the case that you would have the serious business leaders of the city, their interests were very much tied to their cities succeeding. People who ran businesses needed good city services. They needed workers to be educated. They needed to have good relationships with the community to keep labor peace. Today, a lot of that has changed, and so those leaders have less of an incentive, a reason to be attached to what's going on in their communities. But I think one of the key lessons that comes out of this is clearly, in Allentown, what happened out of the crisis was that those people remained tied into what was going on in the community. If you look at the networks and the boards of directors of key civic institutions in Allentown today, you find the names of people who run important banks, who run important companies. So their leadership in the first instance is extremely important. It's not to be discounted. They bring a lot to the table, both in terms of human capital, in terms of social capital, and of course in terms of what their companies can do for the community. But the other key lesson is that what happened in Youngstown happened as a result of all of these different forces going in different directions. So as the crisis emerged, the inability to get labor and management, black and white, suburbs and the city together to effectively engage was a real problem. What drew all those people together, or those groups together in Allentown, was the fact that the business leaders were at the table. So people who had the ability to really get things done were available. And so that created a pull that other people were drawn to who wanted to get things done from all of those communities. And so I think one of the lessons that we need today is, first, make sure that, business leaders are at the table, but second, use that as a draw to get important constituencies together. And each city, you know, those constituencies are different, but whatever they are, wherever the, major fault lines are in the community, there needs to be a place there where everybody can get together and discuss what's going on and come up with plans and then take action and follow through on them.
I want to circle back to the point you made about Robert Putnam. Robert Putnam, of course, wrote a very famous book, Bowling Alone, which chronicled the demise of what he calls social capital. Explain again to me, Sean, where you come down on social capital. Is it something that is needed in the way that Putnam described it? There are many communities that are specifically pursuing the buildup of social capital. Is that a smart thing to do or not so smart?
It's a useful, smart, important thing to do. Where I take issue, or I suppose where I'm trying to differentiate a little bit from Putnam's work, is when Robert Putnam talks about social capital, he's talking about dense connections, right? The idea that we used to belong to clubs means that we were in closer and more frequent contact with people in our communities. And the more that you're in that kind of contact, the denser the ties are. So if you see the world as a network of dots and lines, which there would be a lot of lines connecting all the dots, that density is really important. It's good. It means that you can trust people. It means that information is readily available in that world, and everybody sort of has access to that information. The problem that I see with that is that when things change, that density can get in the way. And Putnam generally isn't thinking about the more macro changes that our economy is going through. He's asking, in the moment, at this time, what makes it work better? And clearly, under certain circumstances, that density of connections is really important. Where I come down on this is to say, when things start to change, you need a broader coalition of people connected, and there are more efficient ways to connect them, right? Connecting the key leaders from key constituencies in such a way that information flows efficiently out into the different parts of the network, and that those key actors can get together and take action without the weight of that massive ball of connections, is a useful thing. Essentially, that leads to the second point, which is that Putnam really emphasizes strong, dense connections, and where I'm coming down on this is to say we need a balance of connections that are dense, but also bridging or connecting across groups, points within our communities where key leaders come together and really get things done. And often that's not everybody getting together. That can just turn into a mess. But key people coming together in a key place is really important.
This reminds me, is this the same idea of people with loose connections? Many loose connections are more likely to get a job.
Right. So you're referring to Mark Granovetter's famous paper called The Strength of Weak Ties. And sure, on some level, it comes down to that, right? So the idea there was that if you ask your close friends where might a job be available, you're not likely to get particularly good information out of them, because if they're there close to you, then they probably know everything that you know, right? It's through our acquaintances that you reach outside of the pool of knowledge that you already have access to find access to new knowledge. So that's definitely part of it. But I guess the step that I take even beyond Granovetter is to talk about how you get things done, collective action, particularly when the world is changing around you. So what was going on in the early 80s, and I think it's certainly arguable today, is that sort of the way the whole world worked, the way industries worked, bureaucratic organizations organized around unified, centralized almost industries with very coherent identities and really focused on the American market, were giving way to what we call now the network society, businesses organized around core competence rather than around vertical integration, global markets versus local markets, and all the rest. The rules of the game that existed at that time were changing, and people needed to adapt to those rules. To the degree that you're embedded in very tight, dense networks, it leads you to cling to the rules of the game that kept that network together. Actually, the sort of relatively loose way that networks were organized in Allentown, I would argue, and I do argue in the book, helped them to adapt. People were less wedded to particular identities within that community and were more able to figure out new identities. One of the stories that I tell in the book is about Lehigh University, and it had the very strong identity, relationship, a connection to Bethlehem Steel. It had produced for generations the engineers and the managers for the company. When Bethlehem Steel went down, it went through an identity crisis, and it had to figure out what kind of university we're going to be. It was able to redefine itself, and it has continued to redefine itself as a regional and a national university, but it also it did so in such a way that it contributed to the redefinition of the entire region. This region went from being a steel town to a more diversified economy, one that was plugged into technology and innovation and entrepreneurship. And the university, as the region changed its identity, the university changed its identity, and the two fed off of each other. That kind of identity change, I think, is really, really key. And, you know, it's partly what happened in Youngstown, that they weren't able to change their identities in such a way that it rebuilt a new identity for the community. And as we go through the current economic crisis and problems, that's just going to accelerate this need to adapt and change the way that we think about the global economy, but more importantly, how we fit into the global economy without abandoning our local identity. That's just going to be really key to keeping a coherent sense of community as we go through this current transition.
What does that say about the kinds of leaders we need locally to lead us through that transition? It's very interesting and very challenging what you describe.
You know, to be honest, what I think about that is that leaders are going to emerge no matter what. And companies are led by people with a lot of skill and a lot of heart and a lot of smarts. And they're going to adapt. Companies will adapt, those leaders will adapt, and they're going to make their way in the world. The question is whether those leaders come to define their own identities as having something to do with their community, that define themselves. So the leaders of utilities, leaders of universities, these are skilled and talented people who are going to make a difference in the world. The question is, will they devote any of those energies to making sure that their community that they're living in, that their companies and their organizations are living in, are tied back into the community, and whether their story has something to do with the city's story, or whether their story is just going to be about themselves and their companies. The incentives are all there for them to go off on their own and do great things for themselves and for their companies. We need to work harder to make sure that they're connected in and that their success is connected into the success of our cities.
And how would you do that if you were the head of the community foundation, if you were mayor? In other words, if you're someone who truly is place-based, where your success depends on the success of the local community, what would you do to draw these others who are more global in their thinking and their success is more dependent on what happens perhaps outside the community, or their fame is more connected to what happens outside the community? What would you do to draw them in more deeply to civic life and local goings on?
My philosophy has a lot to do with crises. So we're in the midst of a crisis, or a lot of our cities are going through crises that require us not to kind of go through rote sort of routine ways of doing things, but to come up with responses that are creative and that require a lot of actual brain power and involvement. And while it's sometimes really hard to get people who are really busy and really talented to focus on what's going on in their communities, this is the kind of opportunity that those people are really well suited toward. They want to be involved in something challenging. Really what I find is that it's out of that kind of experience that they themselves come to whatever success has come out of that, they're implicated in. And patterns are set in motion so that as time goes on, the people who follow them not only in terms of their business leadership, but in terms of the patterns of civic leadership. So now is a time to put together initiatives and plans and get the right folks together in the same room and get them working on really challenging problems. Not only will that help us to get through the current crisis, but it lays the foundation for the crisis that will come, right? This is, in a sense, an opportunity to build up not only the density of connections, but to get people who otherwise wouldn't really have an incentive to come together and meet, to come together and engage together over some really thorny problems. And out of that will come a set of relationships that hadn't existed before that will pay long-term dividends.
Does social networking technology, Sean, change the nature and scope of civic networks and their potential?
I think what it does is it gives us remarkable tools to actually look at the networks that exist and figure out where the opportunities are. Who are the people who are already bridging some of our key constituencies within our cities? How can we identify, you know, who they are and how maybe to give them more support? Where are the organizations that are already linking, let's say, the suburbs and the cities? How do we concentrate our efforts on figuring out where the key ones are and try to strengthen them, you know, make direct other key people in the city who might be helpful in linking up different constituencies in our cities together by directing them to some of those community boards. So, I mean, the technology is there to do some really serious analysis. At the same time, sure, of course, as more and more people, you know, not just 13-year-olds, but everybody is getting on some of these social networking sites, it obviously provides yet another forum or context to create relationships and to exploit those relationships. So I can't think of a city today that's doing a really great job at taking advantage of those technologies, but the technologies are there, and I think we'll learn over time.
Thanks so much for being our guest again, Sean, on Smart City.
Well, thanks as always, Carol. It's really a pleasure.
Sean Safford is Assistant Professor of Organizations and Strategy at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business. His book is called Why the Garden Club Couldn't Save Youngstown. Now for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
It's a move that seems obvious to transit people all over the world. If you're going to build a rail system in a city with an airport, you should probably connect the rail to the airport. But some cities, for a variety of reasons, haven't done that. Los Angeles, for example, has a regional light rail system that comes only as close as about a mile from the city's international airport. In November, Honolulu voters approved the construction of a $4 billion region-wide light rail system. At the time, a route had been selected, and Honolulu was on its way to becoming another city with no link between air and rail. But according to an article in the Honolulu Star Bulletin, to the cheers of transit advocates, a recent vote by the city council has effectively rerouted the rail system away from its original route and into direct connection with the city's airport. And in other good news for transit buffs, it appears plans are being expedited in Toronto to build a new subway line downtown. The National Post is reporting that the so-called Downtown Relief Subway has been bumped up in the planning schedule from its original 25-year blueprint to the more aggressive 15-year timeline. It's a project that augments an existing subway line with a $2.1 billion diversion that runs more directly through an underserved and heavily used downtown core area. Officials are predicting more than 18,000 users per hour on the new line, which many say is exactly why it needs to be fast-tracked. Though the idea is politically popular, up to this point, the city council has only agreed to study the possibility of moving up the timeline. And meanwhile, in the tropics, where rainforest clear-cutting and environmental devastation seem to dominate the news, sensitive jungle land is unexpectedly rehabilitating itself. A recent article from the New York Times looks at how farmland in Central and South America is reverting back to jungles as villagers leave their homes for more lucrative futures in the city. It's a trend being seen throughout the tropics in Latin America and Asia, and while it's been seen as a positive development for the world's threatened rainforests, it's led many to start thinking that maybe protecting these areas doesn't need to be such a high priority. After all, contrarians argue, if these new forests can sprout up relatively quickly, it might not be so big of a deal to lose some of those older forests. The debate on that issue rages, however. And though the new jungle is welcome, scientists aren't quite ready to call it the savior of the endangered rainforest. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll speak with Terry Schwartz of the Cleveland Urban Design Collaborative. She'll tell us how a city of 400,000 uses infrastructure made for 900,000 people. I'm Carol Coletta. And a special welcome to our podcast listeners. You've heard us talk about our social networking site, My City, and the community there has been booming. Hundreds of listeners, just like you, have joined the site and are talking and collaborating on all the issues that mean the most to people who love cities. Want to join? Send us an email to our producer, Scotty, at smartcityradio.com, and he'll get you signed up. I look forward to seeing you online, and now back to the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Many cities find themselves shrinking. As their population declines, they must find creative and productive uses for the land, the roads, and other infrastructure left behind. Terry Schwartz is senior planner at the Kent State Cleveland Urban Design Collaborative, and she leads the collaborative's Shrinking Cities Initiative. She's working to help Cleveland take advantage of its abandoned land assets and reimagine itself for a smaller population. Terry, the population of Cleveland is shrinking. How many people has the city lost?
Cleveland has lost approximately 48% of its population since 1950. At its peak, the city had about 914,000 people, and right now, census projections suggest that we're around 400,000, perhaps a little below that.
Is it fair to say that Cleveland is a city that was built for a million people?
Oh, yes, absolutely, and then some. The city was nearly a million people in the 1950s, and at the time, the city was still growing. It was just the decades following that we've had this exodus. Our region is still substantial. I think we're the 14th or 15th largest metropolitan area in the country, but the population has just dispersed outside of the center city, deeper and deeper into the suburbs.
So there's a lot of land in Cleveland. If Cleveland is a city built for almost twice the number of people, there must be a lot of land, to say nothing of infrastructure, roads, pipes, traffic signals, and the like, that's just no longer needed. What do you do about that?
Well, that's a difficult challenge that we face, but also a kind of a huge opportunity. I mean, right now the city has in excess of 3,000, maybe 3,300 acres of vacant land within city limits. And if you add to that somewhere between 12,000 and 15,000 vacant buildings, you get a sense of the scale and the magnitude of this problem that we face. Cleveland's not the only city like this. There are a lot of declining and shrinking cities in the U.S., and almost all of us have a similar initial strategy, which is targeted toward demolition. And the cities of Cleveland actually is demolishing upwards of 1,000 houses for the last couple of years. In 2009, the goal is to demolish 2,000 houses, which is enormous. The challenge we face, of course, is that you can remove blighted buildings, but if you don't have a strategy for managing the land after that, you're going from one kind of blighted situation to another. So in Cleveland, our goal is to find productive uses for managing, for holding, and for extracting value out of this growing portfolio of vacancy that's within the city. The rhetoric of shrinking cities is that there's nothing to say that Cleveland or Toledo or Pittsburgh or St. Louis can't be a good city with a smaller population. But the challenge we face is that the vitality, the vibrancy, the density of the city is really scattered and also, in some ways, I guess a phrase might be like perforated, you know? You have these pockets of strength and growth and what we think of as a conventional city, but in between there are these vast and growing voids where it's harder and harder to get conventional real estate development to take root.
As Cleveland plans to take down 2,000 buildings this year, is there a location strategy for that? Is there a sense that in this neighborhood we can redevelop, or is it just, it's vacant, it's old, let's take it down?
Gosh, I wish I could show you my maps. It's the challenge of radio. The citywide plan for the city of Cleveland has a series of core investment areas that have been identified and delineated that show the places in the city where real estate development and economic development, population growth, and stabilization are most likely to occur. Like most of the country, we're experiencing this economic malaise, this credit crunch. And so there isn't a lot of real estate development going on right now. But prior to this crisis, the city was building somewhere around 1,500 new housing units a year. Even though we're not growing in population, the city's housing stock is aging, and so there's a need to replenish the housing stock and also to try to attract and to reattract people from the region and from elsewhere in the country back to the center city. So there is this targeted strategy based on market typologies that say these are the places of greatest strength within the city. And the market typology sort of grades every property within the city based on its relative strength and its potential for development, all the way down to sort of fragile and distressed parts of the city where conventional development is not feasible. And so alternative land use strategies are what we're exploring for those places.
Is the designation of an area as ripe for redevelopment, I presume that's done not at a property level, but more at a neighborhood level. Tell me, one, is that true? Is that a good assumption? And number two, how did you make that determination? Development will occur here. We want to invest here. We don't want to invest there. That must have been politically challenging.
Well, the city of Cleveland embarked on this citywide planning process a couple of years ago. And the way that they identified the core development areas was tied to key resources, the river, the lakefront, downtown, the airport, University Circle. These are places of existing strength within the city. The idea being that if you've got these strong anchors in the city, the best strategy is to grow them and to begin to expand the benefits of those areas of strength into the surrounding neighborhoods. If you look at a composite of the city of Cleveland, you would see that the strongest parts of the city are almost exactly adjacent in many cases to some of the weakest parts. So we have things like the Cleveland Clinic, which is this internationally known medical facility, and it's embedded in a neighborhood where we have high degrees of vacancy, poverty, and disinvestment. So the strategy of focusing on these core development areas hopes to capture some of the strongest parts of the city and extend the benefits to some of the areas that are struggling, which begs the question about what happens in the rest of the city, which for the most part, the areas outside of the core development zones are not the strongest or the weakest. They're sort of these neighborhoods that could go either way. They're basically stable. They may be increasing slightly or decreasing slightly in population, but they're basically solid neighborhoods. And my sense from the city is that they think that if we can get the core investment zones stable and growing, that there are benefits that the entire city can reap. It is a challenge, and it's a political challenge. The city has not said that there will be no investment except in the core, but just that these are sort of targeted sites where a lot of the city's energy and resources are being directed.
You mentioned the situation of the Cleveland Clinic, a great anchor next to a neighborhood that is really challenged. What has to happen to take advantage of what you call a core asset?
Well, one of the things that's happening, that's already beginning to happen, it's being largely driven by the clinic itself and also the work of the Cleveland Foundation, is to begin having some of the financial power of the Cleveland Clinic filtering into the neighborhood. And one of the things that the clinic is doing is that they've committed to a substantial amount of their food stream being sourced locally. So the Cleveland Clinic is working with the Cleveland Foundation and the Ohio State Extension to promote urban agriculture in some of the vacant areas of the Fairfax neighborhood that surround the clinic. The clinic's actually stated goal is that 100% of their food for their cafeterias and food service would come from local sources. But I think, you know, even they acknowledge that that's a stretch goal. The likelihood of getting to 100% is pretty slim. But the commitment to local and regional agriculture is something that the Cleveland Clinic is really interested in. The other thing that's happening that's pretty exciting is that the Fairfax Renaissance Development Corporation is actually developing a building, a research building, for the Cleveland Clinic. So the Cleveland Clinic wants to be a tenant. They don't want to develop their own real estate. So rather than working with a private sector developer, they're working with the Community Development Corporation. So the Community Development Corporation is structuring the deal, managing the construction, and they're going to reap the revenue from having the Cleveland Clinic in a facility that they've developed. And then instead of those profits being kind of absorbed by the private sector, the development corporation is going to be able to spend the revenues that they achieve doing beneficial things for the neighborhood. It's a pretty interesting win-win situation because the Cleveland Clinic then, in return, gets a stronger neighborhood, and some of the blighting influences of the surrounding neighborhood can be addressed by their strategic investment of their own dollars.
Now, the Cleveland Land Lab is crafting a new vision for those 33,000 vacant acres in Cleveland, but you're attempting to position this as a strategy not so much for dealing with shrinkage, but for achieving a more sustainable Cleveland. How did you approach that task?
The work of the Land Lab is kind of geared to this question of how can we extract some value from this growing portfolio of vacancy? And yeah, it's not about shrinkage necessarily. It's about correcting some of the mistakes that were made 100 years ago when Cleveland was a rapidly developing city. When there was a lot of market demand for property within the city, there were a lot of crazy and not very good things that were done. I mean, Cleveland has this amazing hydrology, rivers and streams and creeks, but you'd never know it if you came here. here because it's all culverted, and in some cases not even culverted but simply buried. So we're trying to see places where vacant land aligns with ecological resources to see if we can correct these ecosystem problems that happened when the city was rapidly developing, and in a way both stabilize our neighborhoods by taking some of the excess land out of the traditional real estate stream. You know, we know that we are never going to, at least in my lifetime, see the redevelopment of the city of Cleveland the way that it was in 1950. So can we use some of the vacancy to promote community-supported agriculture? Can we use some of the vacancy to address stormwater and water quality issues? Can we use some of the vacant land with, you know, holding strategies that begin to remediate the toxicity that's our legacy as an industrial city? Another map that I could show you is the one of our brownfield sites and our lead toxicity. These are pretty scary maps. And so can we make the city a more sustainable place by using our vacancy in a productive way rather than just as a blighting influence that's beginning to drag the neighborhoods down?
Now, I know you've taken a very detailed approach to this. This is not just conceptual. I mean, you've looked at this in some detail. What are the challenges to getting the things that you propose done?
Well, the challenge right now seems to be making strategic decisions. We've had amazing support from the Cleveland City Planning Commission and from Cleveland City Council. When I initially had to go with my partners from Neighborhood Progress, Inc. to present these materials to the Planning Commission and City Council, I wasn't sure what kind of reception we were going to get. I mean, this is a city and a mindset that's really been driven by development for a very long time. So to suggest these alternative land use strategies that are non-traditional, unconventional, and not driven by traditional economic development and real estate development goals is a new thing for the city. But we've been really happy at what a warm reception these ideas have received from the city. I think the challenge, though, is to begin to understand what to do where. There's a lot of excitement and a lot of enthusiasm for ideas of green infrastructure. You know, how can we manage our stormwater in ways where we're daylighting creeks and installing bioswales? But the thing is, you can't do that everywhere, and that's the message that I've been trying very hard to get across to all of our community partners. The value of the Land Lab work is that it's a framework for decision making, to say that if you're going to deploy a green infrastructure strategy, there are places where the underlying soil and hydrology suggest that that will be effective and you will get a quantifiable return. And there are places where it won't. The same is true with conventional real estate development. There are places where you should build and places where you shouldn't. It's all kind of geared to this traditional Ian McHarg sort of mindset that says in any urban ecosystem, there are places where you can do ecological things and places where you can do built and human settlement kinds of things, and how we begin to choose what happens where. That's the challenge, is how we can begin to make choices, recognizing that not everybody is going to like the hand that they've been dealt. And so where we're going now is into a series of pilot projects to test some of the ideas in the Land Lab work. Throughout 2009, we're working to implement some of the ideas and see what works and see what doesn't. And hopefully we can then begin to figure out how to scale up individual pilot projects to address this large amount of vacant land that we have to manage.
When you think about what you've proposed, and your mindset or your drive here is to extract value out of this growing asset of vacant land, are you also adding cost when you do the kinds of things you're proposing? Doesn't it cost something to maintain or operate these new uses?
Yes, and that's why we're so fixated on the notion of not only extracting value, but being able to quantify it. For instance, from a remediation standpoint, the fact that soil in the city of Cleveland is leading to lead poisoning in thousands of children every year, there's an inherent cost to that. There's a cost to a health assessment for children who've been exposed to lead. There's a cost to treatment for children who have elevated blood lead levels. And there's an opportunity cost over the lives of those children in terms of their reduced potential to be contributing members of our local economy and our society. So for every strategy that we're thinking about for vacant land, we need to quantify two things. We need to quantify the cost of the vacant land strategy and also the benefit of deploying it. Stormwater is an easier one to manage. The city of Cleveland is under all kinds of regulatory requirements from the federal EPA to improve water quality in the Cuyahoga River and in Lake Erie. And if we don't improve water quality, we are going to be assessed with pretty enormous fees. And if we take a traditional kind of engineering approach, there's tremendous cost also to dealing with combined sewer overflows and stormwater management. If we can begin to use greening strategies, green infrastructure strategies on vacant land, we can simultaneously create a neighborhood amenity, but also reduce the city's cost for remediating the pollutants in our water. So the quantification question is important because we're partnering with our sewer district, but they're not going to be interested in seeing a vacant land strategy that incorporates a series of bioswales if we can't also show them that those bioswales will result in a measurable water quality improvement that will help us with our federal compliance.
Let me ask you a technical question, Terry. In your work, have you developed models or calculations that you think other cities can use?
Conceptually, yes. A lot of the things that we're calculating are very Cleveland-specific. But I think that the strategy that other cities can use is simply this: to think about the kinds of problems that a city faces and the ways that vacant land can be used to address those problems. I mean, at the simplest level, we've looked at things like, well, okay, let's say the city of Cleveland wants to have 20% of the apples consumed within city limits that are actually grown in city limits. You can begin to kind of quantify that. So whatever kinds of challenges or needs the city has, whether it's food production or addressing stormwater, you can think about the problem. And then if the problem can be quantified in a way that vacant land can be used to address it, then the calculations will be specific to that community. But the overall notion of using vacant land as a problem-solving tool rather than a liability to be managed is sort of the heart of the land lab work.
Have you explored the question of how to get efficiencies by eliminating or ending the maintenance of infrastructure that's unneeded now?
I think this is a question that comes up in shrinking cities, and there's, I think, an ardent hope that in conjunction with population decline, we can also begin to downsize and reconfigure infrastructure to reduce those kinds of carrying costs. To date, I haven't seen solid research to suggest that there are specific ways that infrastructure can be downsized. For the most part, in dealing with city and county agencies and engineers who manage the infrastructure, the prevailing point of view, at least here in our region, is that it's better to mothball and maintain an infrastructure network at its full capacity rather than incur the capital cost of removing a sewer line or pulling out a street when you don't know for sure whether that will be needed at some point in the future. I had a long conversation about this with the former service director for the city of Cleveland, and I was saying, you know, we could increase the infiltration of stormwater if we can pull out 20% of the streets in the city of Cleveland. And he said, yes, but you can't pull out a street without doing something in its place. In some cities, Youngstown in particular, you see streets that are just have deferred maintenance to the point where they begin to disappear of their own accord. And I suppose that's one strategy, but it isn't really a directive strategy in terms of management. So I just think that the question that you ask is critical and that there needs to be more research to determine where the most viable areas of infrastructure downsizing would be, where it's most likely to generate a cost saving for cities, because we're all stretched. Fewer people maintaining the same amount of infrastructure. The math just doesn't work. And so we need to find the best ways of reducing infrastructure. But I don't think there's a way yet to sort of think about it in a holistic manner at the citywide level.
I remember reading that the people who participated in the planning, the residents of Cleveland, weren't happy with the idea that getting smaller as a community should lead to more density. But then isn't density required to make Cleveland more vibrant?
You know, Clevelanders are not sort of one mind on that topic. There are lots of people who value traditional urban neighborhoods, the walkability, the character, the traditional neighborhood form that has mixed use and convenient local retail, access to transit. You can't have successful transit if you don't have pockets of density. So I think that there's a hope that within this overall composite of the city of Cleveland that we can begin to accommodate a variety of lifestyle choices from traditional urban settlements that are dense and mixed use and vibrant to suburban settlements. You know, I get accused sometimes of this, of wanting to suburbanize the city. And frankly, it's already happened. There are neighborhoods in the city of Cleveland where the density is suburban or almost rural in some neighborhoods. And if we can manage to accommodate these different densities and these different lifestyle alternatives within a single city, I think that we could be on our way to creating a new kind of urban place, one that accommodates a variety of people and a variety of choices, but still has people overall in close proximity to these major cultural and social and recreational assets that a city has to offer.
You said you're going to be testing some of your ideas this year. Tell me what you're planning to do. What's next?
One of the projects that seems to have a lot of momentum is an urban agriculture incubator. It would function like a business incubator, except it would be geared toward promoting local farming. The city of Cleveland has a lot of community gardens, and they've been a wonderful addition because with population loss, we've also seen quite a bit of out-migration of grocery stores, and so access to local produce has become kind of difficult for city residents. So the community gardens have filled that niche, but the urban agriculture incubator aims to take that up a notch and to actually promote commodity farming where people can make a living, an entrepreneurial kind of living, growing food within city limits on some of our larger vacant sites. So the incubator would be setting out to offer training, resources, and tool sharing, ways that local farmers, local entrepreneurs can begin to get a foothold in this business and then from there hopefully expand to larger productive uses. We also want to do a series of stormwater-related projects so that we can demonstrate some of these ideas of reducing the amount of surface flow that's going into the city's storm sewer network. Because like a lot of older industrial cities, we have this terrible combined sewer overflow problem where our sanitary sewer and our storm sewer become one when there's a big storm event, and it happens quite a lot. So we're trying to test some ideas at the micro-neighborhood scale where we can collect and manage stormwater and divert the flow so that we aren't having so many issues with combined sewer overflows.
Terry, it will be interesting to watch your work going forward. I think you're going to produce lessons for all of us. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thank you.
Terry Schwartz is the senior planner for the Kent State Cleveland Urban Design Collaborative. Walker Smith joins us once again to bring some historical perspective on the economic crisis. Our City Views commentator says it's not just the things we do that can help pull us out of recession, it's the things we say.
Words can be like magic, and we need some of that magic now. During the early years of the Great Depression, people got so worried that they stood in long lines to take their money out of banks. These bank runs toppled many banks, yet despite pleas by advisors to declare a bank holiday, President Herbert Hoover refused to do so. FDR, though, ordered a bank holiday immediately upon taking office. During this bank holiday, regulators pored over bank books to determine which ones were healthy enough to be allowed to reopen. 8 days later, FDR was ready to reopen these banks, but before he did so, he wanted to give a radio speech. This speech on March 12, 1933, was the first of his famous fireside chats as president. In it, he urged people to have faith in the banks. He told them it was their patriotic duty to put their money back. These words of his worked like magic. When the banks reopened, people stood in long lines again, only this time to do as FDR had asked and redeposit their money. FDR continued these fireside chats throughout his presidency. He delivered a total of 30 of these half-hour addresses between 1933 and 1944 and attracted national audiences that exceeded the most popular radio shows of the time. His words worked their magic time and again throughout these trying times. Today, we face times that are trying as well. Yet we have no one speaking the kinds of words that can work their magic for us. It is one of our great shared hopes that Obama will turn his eloquence into magic like this. But I think we can even help ourselves in this regard. There are three things for us to do. First, we must turn away from words that preach despair and division. Hysterical news headlines about the economy or pundits who thrive on incivility only undermine our confidence. They do not inspire our allegiance. Second, we must practice the lessons of learned optimism. social psychologists have clear evidence that the words we use to describe and frame our problems determine how we react to them. Optimism and pessimism are not genetic. They are ways we learn to react to contingencies. So we can teach ourselves to approach problems with a greater sense of control and a can-do attitude and rhetoric. Finally, we must talk to one another. We can be an inspiration to others and let others be an inspiration to us. It would be nice to have another FDR to give us reassurance and hope, but we must not wait on that to happen because most likely it won't. Instead, we must take charge ourselves and use words to create our own magic. Obviously, bigger forces will have to fix the macro economy. But we ourselves can be an entirely sufficient force to create the magic that can nourish our confidence in the future. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. If you'd like to learn more about our guest work or find out more about the show, you can go to our website, smartcityradio.com. While you're there, you can subscribe to our podcast, listen to archive shows, or sign up for our weekly newsletter to have the latest news about Smart City delivered straight to your inbox. You can also email us at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our tragically analog producer and engineer. He edited this week's show with a razor blade and scotch tape. I'm Carol Coletta.